Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you've missed any of my talk radio breakfast show, don't worry. We've put some of the punchiest bits of this morning's show into a bite-sized podcast, the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. Enjoy.
Online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
Right now, though, let's talk to Conservative MP, former Brexit Secretary, David Davis. Good morning to you, David.
Good morning.
Good morning. I also have to point out...
I'm just sitting here imagining, you know, some big burly SBS soldiers collecting £10,000 apiece from these.
Absolutely. Well, I was going to ask you about the Special Forces troop, because, of course, you trained with the SAS, weren't you, in the Territorial Army. What do you make of the Special Forces storming the oil tanker? Apparently, after a 10-hour standoff, took them 9 minutes, sent the helicopters in, snipers in the helicopters, some 16 members of the Special Boat Service boarding the vessel, took them 9 minutes to seize control.
Well, I guess it's only about a 5-minute helicopter flight from Poole, which is the headquarters.
Yeah.
And I doubt, frankly, that it was one of their hardest ever tasks. I mean, you know, this bunch of stowaways, basically, I don't know how well organised they were, but it wouldn't have been that difficult for them to subdue them. I mean, the main problem would have been whether they knifed a member of the crew, something like that. And the difficulty there is speed, really, speed and stealth. And they're very good at all of that. So I would think you're dead right. The crew must have breathed a sigh of relief that they picked there to do it, not in the middle of the ocean.
Absolutely. Well, look, let's bring things a bit closer back to home. Let's talk about the various pickles that the Tory government have got themselves in. You're the man who helped campaign.
We got a whole Branston of them, I guess.
We are. Yeah, I mean, we really do, don't we? And it's not the fine cut ones either. It's the big chunky kind of a problems.
Yeah.
Let's go through them in turn, because the one that's on a lot of the front pages, as well as the Special Forces situation, is Marcus Rashford, the millionaire footballer, just got huge support after he's called for free school meal vouchers for the poorest kids to be. He won last time round. The government did a U-turn. The government's saying they're not going to give out these vouchers during this October half term, not doing it for Christmas, but they are saying there will be more cash for poorest families. The government is saying, look, this issue is much more complicated than that, and you need to tackle the issue with not just vouchers or money, but with actually long-term help for these families. Is the government right, or do you think the government should U-turn?
Well, truth is both. I mean, they are right in that, you know, they did create a £60 million fund for local councils to deal with some of these issues directly. They did increase universal credit by about £1,000 a year. But, you know, these actually, for a variety of reasons, these don't actually solve the problems. Not everybody gets universal credit, the so-called legacy welfare people. Not all the councils have used the money in the way that would have met the Marcus Rashford requirement, if you like. But on the other hand, you know, the schools, at the end of the day, should not be a primary arm of our welfare state, you know. So there is a problem. I mean, if you want to look to the sort of wisest person around on this, look at Robert Halfen. You know, Halfen, who voted against the government last week, who's the chairman of the Education Committee, you know, said in terms, no one has a monopoly on benevolence or compassion in this, and it's a really complicated issue. It's got to, you know, you've got things involved in this, like, you know, what about the responsibility of the parents? You're going to bypass the parents every single time in this? Is the state going to take command of that? So it's quite complicated. I think the government's going to have to move. I don't think they have to do what Rashford's asking, but I do think they have to move to help deal with the problem.
But this is the thing, the government's constantly saying, well, you know, this isn't the way to deal with it, we're not going to U-turn, and then they always end up U-turning, don't they? I mean, if they genuinely think they are right, then they shouldn't be in you know, if they think it's a waste of our money, our taxpayers, our money, after all they're handing out, and that there's a better way to make sure children don't go hungry, they should stick to their guns. But they tend not to stick to their guns.
Well, and partly because it's a spectacular handling disaster. I mean, and as it was last time, I mean, the things I've just talked about, the 60 million fund, the sizable increase in universal credit and so on, these are not new. These were known beginning of last week. Where was the government making this case at the beginning? It's making it now, but you know, it sort of walked almost blindfold into a political disaster from its handling point of view. And I think that's part of the problem. You know, it's I think in truth, you know, the what you started out with talking about the number of pickles in. I think that to some extent the government machinery has become overwhelmed, partly by COVID and by other things, and it's not been very good at foresight, at seeing what's coming next. And it's one of the great tricks of good great governments and great leadership is to see what's coming next and deal with it early, not wait until you've got a great panic on your
hands. Okay, well, let's talk about another one of the pickles then, and also another one of the political disasters, and looking at things ahead. All three counts for Dido Harding, Baroness Dido Harding, brought in to handle the test and trace situation. Under no circumstances, there is no way in which you could actually rate the running of this system and think that it was good in terms of the inability to trace, the inability to get test results back quickly and the like. In which case... do you agree with your colleague Sir Bernard Jenkin, who's of course Tory MP and chair of the liaison committee? Do you think that he's right that Dido Harding should be forced out or should quit?
Well, he's half right. I mean, what Dido wants, what Bernard argues, I think, is that they should put a sort of military commander in charge of this. I think he's wrong about that. But the there's no doubt that there is this disaster is probably not too strong a word for it. I mean, if you compare it to somewhere like South Korea, who had managed to do in weeks what we have failed to do in 6 months in terms of setting up a testing, tracking, tracing, and isolation. Not forget the last bit, and isolation policy. They managed to do that in matter of, 6 weeks, I think, 6-7 weeks. And as a result, they've had a much, much better outcome than us. Germany, to some extent, the same. So it's not just one country or just one culture. And we failed to do that. Now, part of it, I mean, I think the biggest part is just the machinery, so-called machinery of government. I mean, why we keep handing out these contracts to these big companies like Serco and Sitel and so on, who frankly have not delivered. They've been very, very poor. They started out, I mean, the head of one of them said something to the effect, oh, well, we're not going to get this running anything before September. He said this like 4 months ago. I mean, that's part of the problem. So there's a systemic problem. In terms of, I mean, we can put too much faith in the individual running it. I happen to think that it perhaps wasn't the smartest thing to give it to Dido Harding. She's a perfectly competent businesswoman. But, you know, I wouldn't employ, I don't know, an oil refiner to run a retail chain.
But exactly, why is Sir Bernard Jenkin wrong in suggesting sort of a military commander, a senior person who's literally been trained for years to run a crisis situation involving huge logistics? That is what they are trained to do. Why not put like that in charge?
The trouble is that I think the problem is a bit simpler than that. I mean, the problem is one of running a set of contracts. I mean, let me give you an example. I asked a question of the department several months ago. I just said, what are the penalty clauses in place if Serco don't deliver? You know, if the companies involved don't deliver. It took them 3 months to come back. And eventually they said, oh, we don't have any penalty.
You're kidding me.
No. It actually said, in English law, it's difficult to have penalty clauses. Well, I never found
rubbish, you have a penalty clause if you have a builder in.
Exactly. There are no bloody penalty clauses. You know, I mean, that's why I say it's not about having a the commander is in a way.
Well, hold on a minute. When people talk about Dido Harding, are we not missing the point? Isn't it actually the case that the person who hired Dido Harding, who isn't doing the job properly, and who's allowing contracts to be signed which are not up to scratch, which wouldn't pass muster in any private business? Isn't it down fundamentally to either Matt Hancock or Boris Johnson? Are they not fundamentally, ultimately to blame?
Well, I think the way they've organised the government is problematic. And where you put the blame for that, well, you can pick. But when they started out in government, actually, almost before this crisis hit us, they heavily centralised Downing Street. Famously, Mr Cummings appointed all his own special advisers under all of the cabinet ministers and so on, and centralise the decision making. Now, when you centralise something, by definition, you take more of the decisions, and those decisions come more rapidly, and they are decisions that you are not expert in, right? And that's what's been going on. I mean, a lot of these decisions have been made by Downing Street. It's got that in common with the Marcus Rashford.
Rashford.
I beg his pardon. Marcus Rashford issue. They are trying to take too many decisions at the centre, and as a result, making mistakes. And I think they're both examples of the same thing. There.
Okay. What do
I'm afraid it comes down to Cummings more than anything else. But it comes down to the person who employs Cummings, surely, at the end of the day.
Yes, exactly. Let's talk about centralised decisions, because one of the decisions the government has decided not to make is to have a full national lockdown. Don't call it a circuit breaker or a fire breaker. It's just another national lockdown. Wales and Northern Ireland have gone ahead. Wales are in a lot of hot water. Mark Drakeford, the First Minister there, over this absurd non-essential shops being forced to close, therefore non-essential items not being sold in supermarkets. What do you make of that decision? And what do you make of the likelihood that we may end up following suit in England?
Well, you know, I think one of your listeners at some point said, you know, we've got to follow the science, one of your contributors. And the trouble is the science in this is incredibly weak. You know, I mean, as they admitted themselves in a government document on Monday of this week, last week, a week ago today, they actually admitted that this is very, you know, the evidence for national lockdowns working is very weak. But the second problem with the so-called circuit breaker is it's going to be more like a power cut than a circuit breaker, because you go in, how the devil are you going to get out? The way other countries came out of their lockdowns, the ones who were successful, were the ones who had, and we're back to the same problem, effective test, track, trace and isolate policies. Yeah. They're the ones who did it. Look at Germany. By the way, when the Germans locked down, they can lock down to a single street, or to a block of flats, or a factory in its dormitory building. You know, that's the sort of level of control. And of course, that lockdown works. Whereas if you lock down 3 million people, let alone 60 million people, but let's say 3 million people in Manchester, Greater Manchester, then there are going to be thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people who break the lockdown one way or another. Yeah. Whereas if it's very small, you can police it. But for it to be very small, you've got to have a test, track and trace.
We come back to that issue, don't we? It's so fundamental. All right.
So fundamental.
Just finally, because I've not got much time and we've got another guest to get to, but very brief, if you would, Brexit, more talks going on, the talks that were ended way over the deadline of October the 15th. Are we going to get a Brexit deal or not?
Am I going to sound like a crack record now? Do you remember the first 3 years matters less than the last 3 weeks? Well, not yet at the last 3 weeks. It will go on and it will go on, and we will eventually get a deal. That's my best guess.
Online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker, Talk Radio.
Right, let's turn our attention back to the Marcus Rashford issue. We tackled that with David Davis about whether or not the government should U-turn and provide free school meal vouchers. 2,000 children's doctors have signed a letter calling on the government to provide them. We've got 800,000 signatures plus on the petition set up by the Premier League footballer calling on the government to U-turn on this. Well, let's ask the Children's Commissioner for England what she thinks. Anne Longfield joins us now. Good morning to you, Anne.
Good morning.
Lovely to speak to you. Should the government U-turn? Should the government provide these free school meal vouchers?
Well, they have been providing them over the pandemic, and I don't think anything has changed. In fact, there's more people who need some more help. So, yes, I think they should. And I think, you know, what we've seen around the country is that so many people have gone out, volunteered, cafes providing some free meals over the next week. And I think that's because they know people are having it tough. They want to help.
The difficulty, I think, for a lot of us who haven't lived in those circumstances or don't live next door to people who are struggling to literally put food on the table for their children is understanding why people could be in that situation. Do we have a benefit system that normally, or today in particular, doesn't provide people with enough money to feed themselves and their kids? We've heard all the talks about people going to food banks and the like.
Yeah.
Is it the case? I mean, your job is to make sure that children are safe and fed and things, you know, looking after the policy issues there. Is it the case that the people on the lowest incomes in this country, whether it's on benefits or minimum wage, do not have enough money, no matter how well they balance their budgets, to feed their children during the school holidays?
Well, for those people that have families and they're on universal credit, then the universal credit system has had big reductions over the last few years, billions of pounds taken out of it. And actually, it's hit families very hard. So there's things around the universal credit has been static, increased more recently. There's issues around the two-child limits. And also some families, you know, you have to wait a period of time. So that's hit a lot of families. And often it's disruptions around the actual benefit system that mean that that families have to go to food banks because they're in crisis. They don't know where to go. But we're talking about a third of children here who are in poverty. And as you say, a lot of those are working. But when I walk into schools, and the first time I saw it, I was literally very shocked, and see a food bank in the foyer of a secondary school, and then a washing machine in the next room so kids can actually wash their clothes. You've got to think that something isn't right here. So
but this government can do
something about it, but it needs a long-term plan.
Clearly something isn't right. And look, no one with any heart at all thinks that children should be, whether it's parents who can't or don't, who won't feed them or look after them properly. We don't want the children to suffer. No one, that they should not have to suffer under any circumstance. Yeah. A lot of people will be querying the whole a third of children in this country living in poverty. We know that's a relative term. You say a lot of those parents are working. I'm sorry, I'll never let this one go. If you've got two parents and they're working between them 2 days a week, I'm sorry, of course you're not paying your bills. You know, okay, there aren't any jobs now, but there certainly have been in the until February. And frankly, those people should be working. If you've got two kids and you can't afford to feed them, I would say go and do a bit more work, frankly, is my answer to that.
But, so of course, most parents do. You know, you've got parents where they take two or three jobs. And
two or three small part-time jobs, but doing 5 hours here and 5 hours there ain't going to fly when it comes to paying your bills and feeding your kids.
You've got parents in reality where they hand the kids over in the car park between jobs and one at work nights and one at work days. Yeah. So I do believe that there are people that are doing their best. Now, of course, those are the jobs that get stripped out when there's a crisis, an emergency. They might be in hospitality. Yeah. They're going to be the jobs that aren't sustainable in the long term. So and they'll just go. So a lot of people have gone on to that. We know that 450,000 1,000 families have signed up for universal credit over the pandemic. But I think when it gets to it, the last line of defense is that kids need food. And, you know, I've had kids, the brightest kids, talk to me about their circumstance, their parents being at work. And it's just that anxiety that just creeps into their life. They know their parents are really worried about it. The parents try and hide it from them and miss meals. Yeah. But they know that sometimes there just isn't food in the cupboard.
Yeah, I completely understand that. But what I'm saying is, are we saying that the universal credit system does not provide enough money? And even if you're on universal credit, you can't afford to feed your kids? Because I'm guessing there are millions of parents out there who are living on the lowest incomes who do manage to feed their children single day. So, what's the difference between those two families? It's not money, is it?
Well, first, there's two things. One is that it doesn't happen overnight. It builds up.
Yeah.
So if you get into debt, if you have to buy warm clothes during the winter, if you get a bill that comes in, if your car that you're keeping going, you know, on just a bit of petrol now and again breaks down, that tips you over to a place where you haven't got the resources to be able to get through that place. Yeah. You know, if you're bringing your kids up alone, which, you know, a lot of families are, that's only one person that can do everything. Yeah. Look after the kids at home, even if they're drawing on family as well. So there are families who get into that situation, and it's bottom line, it's through no fault of children that they're in that situation. So government is doing, you know, it has been very generous over recent months, and it's put so much money into things like the furlough scheme. But when we're looking at the great things that government's invested in, if we can't put kids and their free school meals onto that list that we're proud to do, then I think something's gone very badly wrong.
But the issue is that the furlough scheme is supposed to be a temporary measure. We're talking about the free school meals issue. Is that something that should go on forever? Does the state take over responsibility for feeding millions of children in this country every summer, Christmas and half-term holiday?
I actually don't think anyone is asking for that, because that's not the desired solution, really.
Solution next time around? If we're feeding the kids, we did it for summer, if we did it for this half term, if we did it for Christmas, because we are the taxpayers who'd be paying for other people. Why not next Easter holiday? Why not next summer holiday?
Well, I think it does need to run until the Easter holidays, because the pandemic is here with us. People aren't going to be able to pick up new jobs in that meantime. So we shouldn't be surprised when we get back to this situation come February, March, if the plan isn't in place. But in the long term, there needs to be a realisation that this is the way that families are having to live their lives. There needs to be a better social security net there that is more attuned to families' real life. And also, I think, real help through things like family hubs, children's centres, Short Start, to help those kids and help those families along the way. It can't just be they're left to themselves and then they're a cliff edge. But we are in the middle of a pandemic, so we do, I think, have to make extraordinary measures and put those in place.
Online, on DAB and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
But let's talk to Tobias Elwood now. He's chair of the Defence Select Committee, Tory MP for Bournemouth. And Tobias, lots of things to talk to you about. But first up, I want to talk to you about Marcus Rashford, because you are one of the few Tory MPs to sort of vote against and to come out with the government against their policy and say that Marcus Rashford is right and the government should U-turn on free school meals. Why do you think so?
Well, I think you've jumped ahead. There's an awful lot to discuss. I mean, firstly, let's go back to that vote. It was an undignified display of the House of Commons. Labour posed the question, either you support free school meals or you want our kids to starve, and glossed over actually how different we are today compared with when we first addressed this back in spring and the summer, where absolutely it was right to provide that free school meal provision during holidays. Now we have £9 billion extra funds of support for welfare, universal credit has increased, councils themselves, such as my own one, Bournemouth, Christchurch and Poole, have received additional funds to provide support. And I don't think the Conservatives have done well enough to spell that out. But what we're seeing here is a national debate, a desire actually to say, let's keep it in place. It's tried, it's tested, it's practical, it's been used before. And if it's one of the many vehicles that we provide that welfare support, then I do hope that we can get something in place by Christmas, which allows us all to move forward. Because we've got to recognise that the impact of this pandemic has been huge on everybody, but of course on this generation of children who have not seen their lives interrupted in ways not seen since the war.
No, indeed. I think everyone thought it was going to be the elderly who were most affected by this. And obviously, in terms of deaths, they are. But in terms of those still living, it's the youngest people who've been affected the most. Let's turn our attention to what I really wanted to talk to you about. And this is this extraordinary story about the Special Forces storming the oil tanker off the Isle of Wight. You, as the Defence Select Committee Chair, but also, as you mentioned, your constituency contains Poole, which is where the Special Boat Service, rather conveniently, are based and do their training, just a few miles away from where this tanker was effectively taken over by these seven stowaways. Incredible work by the Special Boat Service. After a 10-hour standoff, took just 9 minutes in total to seize control of the boat. Your thoughts on that?
Well, they don't hang about, do they? But if you are going to hijack an oil tanker, don't do it 10 miles off Poole. That is the key message here. An excellent result. We can be very proud of our Special Forces. Indeed, all the agencies that were involved in that. The crew is safe, the vessel is secure, the hostiles are detained, no fatalities, no injuries, an extremely professional multi-agency response. And it proves that we have some of the most professional armed forces and indeed military capabilities and indeed police in the world. Very, very proud, I think we can be, that it's ended the way it's done.
Well, indeed, again, with no loss of life, no injuries, as far as we're aware. Now, it doesn't appear to be a hijack situation in the full sense of it. It doesn't appear to be a situation of piracy. These were stowaways who the crew had known about for some time since they were found after they set sail from Lagos in Nigeria. It was only when they were approaching shore that these stowaways started to be threatening and apparently threatening violence. How common is this? I mean, we know about piracy in the seas off the coast of Somalia, but how common is this situation?
It's worth mentioning that those events off the coast of Somalia, because that's introduced new protocols for every civilian crew on board these big oil tankers as to what they should do when these situations occur. There's something called the citadel, that old word that we found in castles. We now have them on board of ships, a very safe room where they can actually go into to protect themselves and then allow the emergency services to then take over control. As soon as word came through that there were seven stowaways on board and the ship's crew were not fully in command of the vessel, that would have triggered a multi-agency alarm. And then well-rehearsed protocols, classified protocols, would have then tripped into place, covering the full spectrum of potential outcomes, including what you just touched on, you know, from some form of terrorist attack or using this vessel as a crude weapon to cause harm onto the South Coast.
Well, that's it, isn't it? This does appear, from what we know now, and no doubt more information will come out, as there no doubt is a court case coming, that it's not, these aren't terrorists, these are stowaways. Still illegal migration, still a crime. However, this does raise concerns that this could be used as a form of terrorism, a way of gaining access to this country, or even if, you know, people started releasing the oil from the tanker into the seas and the like. How big are those concerns for you on the Defence Select Committee?
Absolutely. We have to recognise that the character of conflict is changing immensely. It's no longer military might building up either side of an iron curtain. There are non-state actors, as we see here, that may wish to cause us harm. Whether it be Nigeria, you have Boko Haram there, an extremist organisation. In Somalia, there's Al-Shabaab. Daesh has not disappeared from the Middle East at all. These countries want to undo the way we operate. They want to challenge the way we live. And if weaponizing a crude system such as an oil tanker, it's not too dissimilar from the mindset of those who flew aircraft into the Trade Center over in the United States. We need to be on our guard. We need to recognize and advance our own security mechanisms to make sure that this is in place. And that's exactly what the SBS, other special forces, indeed our police as well, do to make sure that they can contain such situations very, very quickly indeed. We can be immensely proud of what our armed forces did yesterday in closing the situation down, given the different directions it could have gone.
Across the UK, online, on DAB and on your smart speaker, Talk Radio.
Thanks for listening to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and give me a good review. And don't forget to catch me on the Talk Radio Breakfast Show every weekday from 6:30 until 10.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.